Hey guys, welcome to another episode of the Entertainment Now Podcast. My name is Nick.
I'm Ian.
Like always, if you're watching this on YouTube, make sure you give us the old thumbs up. You know, give us a drop a comment, all the fun YouTube-y kind of stuff. What's been going on, Ian?
Nothing, except I think I've developed my own conspiracy theory.
Oh, really? What's that?
It's nothing really overly fascinating, but these are the things that pop into my head when I'm trying to sleep.
Okay.
So I am going to postulate that the pharmaceutical industry doesn't like fluffers.
Why is that?
Because Viagra has put fluffers out of business.
Well, I mean, I guess, but, you know, fluffing has a different kind of role. It's kind of keep the energy going.
Viagra is there to
kind of ramp everything up initially.
But it can last for hours, so I mean, it's like
it shouldn't last. If it lasts for more than 3 hours, is it 3 hours? 3 or 4 hours?
4 hours.
You have to go to the hospital, and then that's not good because you know what they do?
I know what they do.
A big needle, and they drain blood out of you. Not good. So.
So it sounds exciting. I need to try it.
So there is an interesting conspiracy theory that just came out within the last several weeks.
Hmm.
And that is that O.J. Simpson did not kill his ex-wife in Ron Goldman.
It was his son.
No, because that conspiracy has been around for a while.
Yeah, that one's been around a long time.
No, there's this new conspiracy that it was actually the mafia. That O.J. Simpson hired mafia thugs to murder his ex-wife.
Huh.
So there's a guy that came out after O.J. died and said that he felt it was okay, that he was safe to talk about it now because O.J. was gone. All the mafia hitmen guys were all gone also. OJ was kind of the last piece that he was waiting for before he could discuss it. But he said that he had firsthand knowledge, or I don't know if he had firsthand knowledge or he heard it from one of the mafia hitman guys that OJ owed these mafia guys, these mafia hitmen, a lot of money.
Uh-huh.
So he paid them what he owed them plus a bunch more money. Basically put a hit on his wife. And Ron Goldman, you know, like we've thought
was
collateral damage, which I've always kind of thought that.
Hmm. So wouldn't there have been a money trail of some kind? I mean, it'd have to be. If you paid a bunch of money. They had to have looked into all that. I mean, he was on trial.
Yeah. But I don't know, though. Like, if you have, like, I don't know OJ's financial situation. I don't know if he had large amounts of cash that he had available.
Right.
Because if that's the case, you know, if he had, you know, a couple of hundred grand in a vault in his house in cash and then paid them out of that, there really would be no paper trail.
True, but it's like, it's unlikely that that would have been the case. I mean, who has that kind of money just laying around?
Yeah. And they said, he said that.
And that wasn't even, I mean, was he living there? He wasn't even living there.
No.
Right?
No.
But OJ, his other house.
He was living at his own house. But this guy said that when the hit went down, OJ was there. And that's why there was the bloody glove. That's why there was the bloody footprint. You know, that's how the evidence of his being there was there, because he was there when it all happened. Mm. He was just standing there, and he was watching it all happen.
Well, I mean, that would make him as guilty as, I mean, it's, he's guilty anyway, but
yeah.
I don't know. The sun theory actually kind of does make sense.
See, I don't think the issue I always had with it is Ron Goldman was a pretty in shape guy.
Right.
So one of them had to basically stood there and watch the other one be murdered. Right. That's why I've always thought.
But OJ didn't have any bruising or anything either. He didn't have any defensive wounds.
So he did, but he didn't. So there was, he did have wounds on his hands. So he left. So the murder happened, and then he was on an airplane to Chicago within 2 hours of it.
Mm-hmm.
The way it happened, the way the timeline rolls out is he finds out about the murder while he's in Chicago. He hops on a plane and comes back to L.A. Investigators in L.A. call out to Chicago PD, have Chicago PD go to the hotel room that O.J. was in. There was blood in the bathroom. O.J.'s story was he cut his hand on a broken glass, and that's how he had injuries to his hands, and that's where the blood came from. That's OJ's story. My thing has always been, though, you know, OJ is also a pretty big, pretty in-shape guy, even though he was, you know,
older.
You know, he was a professional athlete. He was always in shape. But it was 2-on-1. And there were numerous stab wounds. I want to say there was like over 20 stab wounds to Ron. I know there's a bunch to Nicole also. So that's why I've always thought that there's always been the possibility, at least in my mind, it was always likely that there was a second person there.
Right.
And that's where the whole, what was the Cato Caitlin thing kind of made sense. You know, hey, him, you know, Cato was living on his property. He always seemed kind of like a weird guy. Maybe he was involved. Maybe he was the accomplice that was there. Maybe, and I'm not even saying that necessarily he went there with OJ to commit this crime. It was just he was with OJ when it's all going down. He's like, oh shit. And he got involved during this murder. Right. Somehow one of them had to have been distracted, or cause one of them was attacked and murdered basically the other one was. But, I know Ron had a lot of defensive wounds on him.
Okay.
So there was definitely a struggle there, which makes me think that if there's a struggle between the two of them, then Nicole was probably already dead at that time. So does that mean that Ron stood there and watched Nicole die? Mm-hmm. Right? I mean, I don't know. It's.
Yeah, I mean, we'll never know, but, you know. Hmm.
I'm sure, I know that OJ was there, at least. I think he probably did it. But
Some of it.
Or he participated in it. So, but I don't know if he was fully the only one that was there. That's kind of the thing that I know there's only one set of bloody footprints.
Right.
You know, I don't know.
Well, it's, I mean, if he was there with a hitman would know better.
Yeah. You're probably right. That's an interesting conspiracy, I thought.
Yeah. Yeah. I was having trouble sleeping, so I went down the rabbit hole of conspiracy theories surrounding like celebrities and stuff.
Yeah.
That was one of them, was that his son had done it. I never heard that before.
Yeah, that one's been around since the 90s. There's always been that conversation.
Yeah. But there's pictures of his son with the hat? Some hat and some shirt or some whatever, some part of the evidence that was presented that had blood or something on it.
Okay.
There's pictures of him wearing those things.
Okay.
That was taken prior to the actual murders.
The thing that's always kind of made, that I've always found funny, I guess, about that trial is the fact that, you know, there's this bloody glove that's found at the crime scene, right?
Uh-huh.
And there is video of OJ wearing the exact same fucking glove on TV. Like from, I think it was the previous fall before the murder. I've always said that if that trial happens 16 months later, 18 months later, there's no way that he is found not guilty.
Really?
Yeah, because it was right at the beginning of, you know, DNA evidence existed.
Right.
But it wasn't where it would be a year and a half later. You know, by the time, you know, a year and a half, 2 years later, I think that DNA evidence would have been a nail in the coffin for OJ.
Well, they talked to some of the jurors too, and they some of them said that they believed he was guilty, but they went innocent anyway, because
really,
to stick it to the LAPD, yeah.
Well, I mean,
it was the, right. I mean, it's the time period.
the LAPD did a lot of wrong stuff, you know, for right. a very long time.
Yeah, and that, there's one lady specifically who said that she, if it had been anyone else, she probably would have said guilty, but it was right after that. It was her way of kind of saying fuck you to the LAPD.
Really? That's so, yeah. It's a good way of taking your civic duty seriously there, right?
Well, I mean, if you're an African American living in LA in the early 90s,
yeah, you know, absolutely.
How civic minded can you be?
You're right.
So,
but
and that's why I didn't. When I saw that little clip, I was like, well, I get it.
It makes sense.
You know, I don't agree with it, but I get it.
Yeah, you know, so. Yeah. The LAPD was notorious for. I mean, hell, look at Rodney King and all the other stuff. You know,
well, that's what they were really
that was
pointing out.
Yeah,
because that led the to kind of, the riots and everything.
That's the kind of stuff that was commonplace in South Central Los Angeles. So, you know,
well, commonplace everywhere, unfortunately.
Yeah, but the LAPD had like a, you know, 40-year at that time, like a 40-year history of brutality and planting evidence, and you know, so it made you know you bring up the possibility in the OJ trial of racist police officers who were on at least recordings using, you know, racial slurs and things like that. It's easier to paint this picture, especially in someone who, you know, if you're a black person living in LA in the 90s, in the early 90s, it's easier to paint that picture of them planting this evidence on OJ because you've already introduced evidence that these are, in fact, police officers that...
Who do that.
Who use racial slurs, even if they're not necessarily racist, they are okay with racism, you know?
Correct.
So it's easier to paint that picture.
Well, it's, you know, if it's that endemic within the LAPD, even if it's just a handful of officers...
Yeah,
it's still it's there, and you can't. It pulls into question everything.
Yeah,
that they do. So.
Yeah, I mean, and that was kind of the whole linchpin of the trial was Mark Furman. It was Mark Furman's role in the investigation of O.J. Simpson.
Right.
You know, Mark Furman's history when it's related to, you know, racism, things like that. Whether or not it, you know, whether it was you know, a fair assessment or not, it was he was able to open that door and to let the possibility come in. And that's the whole thing, that when it comes to, you know, being a witness in a trial, you know, if there's even a sliver of a possibility the person didn't do it, you'd find him not guilty.
Shadow of a doubt.
Yeah. Yep. You know, and that's where, you know, he was found guilty in a civil trial because there isn't that level of proof that needs to be shown in a civil trial.
Correct. Yeah. You know?
A civil trial is just, is this likely to have happened? Yes. Okay. Then you find them guilty.
Right.
We didn't come here to talk about OJ.
No.
But there was something I did want to talk about real quick before we get to our topic. So. Okay. We're both fans of sitcoms. At least I'm a big fan of sitcoms. I have been for a long time.
Yeah.
So
we grew up on them. So.
So Barstool Sports on Instagram has a entertainment page called Lights, Camera, Barstool. So they did this bracket. So this is the tournament style bracket that they put together of the top 16 sitcoms of all time. This has to be the worst fucking list I've ever seen in my life. I don't know who ended up winning the bracket. It didn't. I mean, that was kind of irrelevant to me. I'm just going to kind of run down through these.
Okay.
So you know how how these brackets work, right? You know, you got 16 teams. So one
kind of
one faces off against 16, 8 faces off against 9, 4 faces off against 13, and so on and so forth. So
I don't know how that numbering works, but okay, I get it. Yeah.
So the best team plays the worst team, and then, you know, so on and so forth until you meet in the middle, and then 8 plays 9, basically. Okay. So
You said 1 plays 16 and 8 plays 9. Shouldn't it be 1 plays 16, 2 plays 15?
Yes. But the way the bracket goes is the 1-16 winner would play the 8-9 because they're in the middle. So
Right.
Okay. So I'm just gonna run down through this bracket. You tell me who you think would win each one.
Okay.
And then we'll discuss why this list is so horrible, because in my opinion they have some of the best sitcoms of all time that they don't even have in this tournament. All right.
Okay.
So number one, they've got Seinfeld against number 16, Married with Children.
Okay.
Which one did you pick?
I mean, it's a personal pick, but I'd pick Married with Children.
So would I. I've never been a fan of Seinfeld. I get the, you know, they were kind of a cultural phenomenon. I get all that. And but I was never a big fan.
Yeah.
So the 8-9 matchup, you've got Scrubs versus Parks and Rec.
That's a tough one, 'cause I like them both a lot. As far as like Scrubs is probably much more culturally important.
Yeah.
Because Parks and Rec was always kind of seen as like the Office stepbrother or stepsister, however you want to look at it. I mean, it started life as a spinoff, but it took on a life of its own. But so I'd probably have to go with Scrubs for the competition.
So would I.
Personally, I might go with Parks and Rec over it, but you know, if I'm being rational about it, I think I'd have to say Scrubs.
All right, so the 4-13 matchup, you've got number 4 seed, Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Okay.
Against the number 13 seed, which should be all, it's criminal that this is rated so fucking low. That 70s show. Curb Your Enthusiasm or That 70s Show. Which one are you picking?
Again, that's probably personal because I really never watched Curb Your Enthusiasm that much. I think I could say I've watched maybe 2 or 3 episodes tops.
I mean, it's a good show. I think.
It's Seinfeld humor. I mean, that's what it is. So, yeah. I mean, I would go with That 70s Show.
So would I. But. So would I. All right. So for the 5-12 matchup, you have the number 5 seed, Friends. Am I boring you to death yet, Ian?
No, I'm just tired. Go ahead.
I've got the number 5 seed, Friends, against the number 12 seed, Arrested Development.
Oh, Friends.
Yeah.
Even though personally I would pick Friends, culturally, Friends.
Like, how is Friends at number 5?
Right, as a seed, they should be a much higher seed.
Especially since number 2, so the number 2 seed, so we're going over to the other side of the bracket. The number 2 seed, It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Okay. They've got that rated over Friends, which is a good show. I like it.
Yeah, I love It's Always Sunny, but it's not Friends.
Against the number 15 seed, Cheers. That's a hard one.
Sounds to me, but it sounds to me like whoever picked where these shows were ranked before the competition probably wasn't born until like 1995 or later. That is a tough one because
It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. They are.
They're very different. It's like, how do you even compare them?
I mean, I like It's Always
Cheers
Sunny.
Cheers was a phenomenon. It's Always Sunny is never. I mean, it's a cult phenomenon, but it's never been a societal phenomenon, whereas Cheers was.
Yeah. I'd have to go with Cheers on that one.
Yeah.
So then you got the number 7 seed, The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, against the 10 seed, Community.
Well, I'm going to go Community.
So would I.
Straight across the board. Don't get me wrong. I mean, we grew up with Fresh Prince. We were watching that. I mean, that was big for us. Because that was, 89 when that started?
Yeah, somewhere around there.
90?
Yeah.
Somewhere like
that.
Yeah,
somewhere
that. Maybe 91 at the latest. But,
yeah.
I mean, that was, you know, our very early teens. We were just becoming teenagers when that came on. Yeah. So, yeah, that's.
And The Fresh Prince was a great show. Also very different than other stuff that was going on at that time. I mean, it touched on topics that other sitcoms weren't even going close to around that time. But so then you've got the number 3 seed, The Office, against the 14 seed, Malcolm in the Middle.
Well, again, this is going to be personal. I'm going to go with The Office for sure.
So, so would 100%. I. And I'm not even a big fan of The Office.
Malcolm in the Middle is kind of forgettable.
It really kind of is.
It has moments where it's like, wow, they got away with that. But then it's like, it's forgettable. Whereas The Office, I mean, you can't go through a list of memes without finding an office.
Exactly, anywhere, exactly. You know, so. And then the last of the bracket is the 6 seed Veep versus the 11 seed 30 Rock. They're both good shows.
Yeah, I never watched Veep. I don't know. Yeah. So, I mean, I go to 30 Rock.
I watched the first season of it, but yeah. I mean, I still thought 30 Rock was a much better show.
And it, I mean, this just kind of goes to what I said about whoever put the initial rankings together is way younger than us. But where's MASH? Where's All in the Family?
Exactly. I know. Where's Modern Family, Ian?
Where's Modern Family? Like, well, I'm just thinking, MASH still holds the record for the most viewed finale, scripted show of anything ever. It still holds that record 40 years later. Yeah.
That's why I said there's a lot of big sitcoms that aren't in this list.
Right. How is that not relevant? Oh my God. I mean, don't get me wrong, the show's been off the air for 40 years. Yeah. It ended 40 years ago, 41 years ago now. So I can understand kids, younger people not getting that.
But having Malcolm in the Middle listed on there and not MASH? I mean, that's
not MASH.
That's one of the big ones. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia is a good show, but MASH? I mean, like I said, Modern Family? I mean,
right.
I don't know. It's
Modern Family is one. I kind of consider that a sleeper show. It's funny because I didn't watch it when it was on. I came to it much later. I've now watched the whole series all the way through twice.
Yeah.
And I love the show. It's in my top 10 of shows of sitcoms, honestly. But it's funny. You don't ever hear anyone talk about it until you mention it. And then you're like, I was watching Modern Family. Oh, I love Modern Family. Everybody loves it. But no one ever talks about it. You know, it's weird how that works.
Not only that, like how they rank them, but some of the very glaring show, some of the shows that were just
omissions.
Like, the omissions are horrible on that list. Yeah. But I don't know. I thought it was interesting. I just wanted to bring it up real quick just because, you know, I thought it was like just horrible. Not only the shows they missed on there, but some of the rankings were just, you know, huge question marks for me also. But you know, yeah, just you're right though. I think it's whoever put that list together. I'm sure it's Barstool. So they're all like, you know, 20, you know, probably late 20s to early 30s.
That makes sense.
Which would make sense why they've got some of those shows ranked the way they do. But yeah, I just thought it was really interesting. But that's not what we came here to talk about. We came here today to talk about a great album. It was released 30 years ago now. I think, it was February 1st, 1994, that is Dookie by Green Day. I will say that I have the first pressing on CD because it's got Ernie on the back of it.
Ernie.
Which it was only available, I think it's on the first pressing on vinyl also has Ernie. Pretty sure the band got a nice cease and desist letter from Sesame Street after the release of that album.
Which is silly because it's a blurry picture anyway.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious that is. Can you see that, by the way?
Yeah, I can see it. It's I know it's Ernie, but it just, you know.
I didn't know if my camera was picking that up well enough or not, but.
Right.
Yeah, I got this used for like $5 a few years ago. I was at there's a used CD store down in Ohio, and I was just going through their used stuff, and I just had to pick it up one day. I picked up the copy of Dookie and flipped it over, and I was like, oh, that's got Ernie on the back. I know that's a first pressing, so bought it for $5. I know it's not really worth anything, but I think it's kind of cool to have the first copy available on CD. Because I don't have a first pressing on vinyl goes for like hundreds of dollars, so.
But. Right. And yeah, there's, I mean, we I know you've got a couple copies of it, don't you? On vinyl?
No, I only got the box set that came out last year. And then I have the anniversary edition, it was a Walmart exclusive that they released last year or the year before. It's on like light blue vinyl. I did have two other copies of it. I sold both of them.
Okay. As I say, I have whatever 2015, 2016, whatever year they did. I mean, it might've been 2014, I guess, a repressing. That's the version I've got.
Yeah. But, so this was an album that it was basically my introduction to punk music. At that time, I was into bands like Guns. I was heavily into Guns N' Roses. I'd gotten into Metallica. You know, I kind of ventured away from some of the hair metal bands of the late part of the 80s. And it was really kind of, forming a new, I guess I should also say that I'd gotten into like grunge also, obviously. You know, 1991, 1992, some of the biggest grunge, you know, that's when grunge really kind of took hold. And if you weren't Metallica, you know, everything else kind of got pushed aside by grunge music. So I really got into bands like Nirvana and Pearl Jam. But by the time 1994 rolled around, you know, it was kind of, grunge was over. You know, that was the year Kurt died. You know, grunge was kind of, bands were kind of moving away from that grunge sound. And, I think for me personally, I was, you know, 14 when the album came out. I turned 15 that summer, but you know, for me, I was kind of looking for something new. And then, you know, Longview, which was the first single off the album, I just looked it up. Longview was released as a single the day the album came out. So, and, you know, within the next couple of months, I mean, that song blew up and it was all over MTV.
Right. And for me, I remember seeing it early on, like before Basket Case, but Basket Case was the one that really, like, I was like, oh, that's that band from that other video.
Yeah. Basket Case was August 1st of 1994, so that was released just before Woodstock 94.
So that would have been August, you said?
Yeah, that's what I said, August 1st.
August. Yeah. So that was my kind of my true introduction, because Longview would come on, and I, you know, on MTV, and I noticed it, but I didn't like, ooh, what is that? You know, but Basket Case, you know, for sure really caught my attention.
Yeah, because there was four singles off that album. You had Longview, Basket Case, which was released August 1st, Welcome to Paradise, which was released in October, and then When I Come Around, which was released in December, which I don't remember When I Come Around being a single. Oh, yeah, I do. Now that I think about it, it's the video where they're walking around, I think.
Yeah, and it's funny because I can't picture the video right now. I can picture Longview, I can picture Basket Case, but I can't picture Welcome to Paradise.
Yeah, I think the first two singles were both very iconic videos, so I think it's kind of why they're easier to remember. But like I said, Green Day was my introduction to punk. It wasn't like, I don't really consider it like a gateway album for me though, because I didn't really go out and like seek out other punk bands after getting into Dookie. It really wasn't until An Out Come the Wolves, which was released in 95. After that was released, that's when I really got into Rancid and I discovered Operation Ivy and all this other great punk bands around that time.
Even the Ramones, I think they were always kind of on the periphery of classic rock music for me. But after hearing Green Day and all that stuff, that's when I would start to experiment and listen to Ramones and some of the older stuff.
Yeah. The Clash.
The Clash, the 70s stuff. Sex Pistols, not so much the Sex Pistols. I mean, Anarchy in the UK was kind of the only thing I was ever really familiar with.
But the funny thing was, until like the, you know, 94, 95, if I thought of punk music, it was Never Mind the Bollocks. Like, that was punk to me. You know, and now, obviously, 30 years later, I'm like,
we know better.
The Sex Pistols were the, you know, the 70s punk version of the Backstreet Boys.
Right. You
know, they were a band that was put together by Malcolm McLaren, who had spent a summer or a year in New York in the mid-70s and saw the punk scene and saw the Ramones and everything else that was going on in New York City. Went back to England. with his clothing store and was like, hey, I want to sell more clothing. So these kids were coming into his shop. So he's like, hey, let's form a band. And, you know, kind of went from there. It was basically a publicity stunt, you know, that Johnny Rotten has lived a career off of.
Yeah. I mean, it's really no different than, like you said, Backstreet Boys or any of those bands. I mean, those are all manufactured groups too, but yeah. You know, for what it's worth, they never pretended to be anything else, whereas the Sex Pistols did.
Yeah. So, the funny thing is the kind of funny thing with Green Day and the Sex Pistols though is Billy Joe Armstrong very famously made fun of the over commercialization of the Sex Pistols, and then the early to mid-ish part of the 2000s, Green Day did the exact same thing. Like, Green Day had their own fucking Broadway show.
Right. You know. Yeah, you couldn't go anywhere without seeing, Green Day stickers for sale and, you know, the same as everything. If there was something for Sex Pistols, you could find that exact same thing with Green Day on it. You know, so.
Yeah. It's kind of funny, but. Who knows? You know, Green Day was part of this really interesting thing that was happening in the late 80s in the Oakland area, in the East Bay, which we had bands like Green Day, Operation Ivy, which Green Day and Operation Ivy played shows together. Actually, at one point, Billy Joe was invited to join Rancid. And he was like, I've already got this other band that I'm working on and we're doing things with. So he ended up not joining Rancid, but they played a lot.
What role would he have played?
Guitar.
What role would he have played?
It was
just guitar, not singing, because Tim Armstrong's a vocalist, right?
Well, I mean, but that's the thing is, like, so when Rancid started, it was a 3-piece band, and it wasn't until their second album when Lars joined the band. Lars played guitar. Lars, was a kind of a co-singer. There are songs that Lars sings in the band. So that was the role that Billy Joe would have played in the band. But, obviously, I think they obviously went the right way, getting Lars and, Billy Joe keeping with what he was doing with Sweet Children / Green Day. So what they were doing in that, like I said, the late 80s, early part of the 90s, really would kind of change punk music there in the mid-90s and kind of from there. Yeah, I mean, because like I said, you didn't get into Dookie for a while. So at what point did you get into the band?
Honestly, it was you playing it in your car and stuff. Not just that, but, mostly I would say Nimrod. Because when Nimrod come out, that's all you had in your car forever.
Yeah.
I just, every song, every time I'd listen to the songs on Nimrod, I'm like, that's actually pretty good. That's really good. Oh, I really like that song. And it just made me go, maybe I need to reevaluate all of this, I always liked Brain Stew, even though it was, two chords and nothing going on there. I liked the vibe that the song had. I always liked that, but
I feel like
it was probably after listening to Nimrod, and then that kind of forced me to go back and, like I said, reevaluate all of it.
Yeah, I think Nimrod was a more experimental album than anything the band did. I mean, yeah, because what they were doing with Insomniac was, I mean, they were more experimental with Nimrod, but they experimented on Insomniac. But I don't think it wasn't quite what they were doing on Nimrod. Nimrod was, they incorporated so many different sounds into their punk sound to form Nimrod. There was, and that's kind of the one thing I could say about Green Day during the 90s is each album after Kerplunk was almost a sound in itself, Dookie sounded like a more polished version of Kerplunk, but Nimrod was almost like this, they'd gotten so much backlash from, because they went mainstream or they joined a major label that, Nimrod was like almost like this middle finger to everyone because of what the band had all been through. And then I think they kind of incorporated some of the stuff from Insomniac and then some of the stuff from Dookie, and then they recorded Nimrod.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely an evolution there, but ultimately what got me to Dookie was, like I said, probably Nimrod, you playing Nimrod a lot. And then, once time went on, then you started Kerplunk and Dookie. For some reason, I don't remember you playing Dookie quite as much as those other albums.
I played Dookie a lot.
But Kerplunk, I remember, like, for the longest time never came out of your player in your car. Same with Nimrod.
Yeah, until you melted my copy.
I put your copy of Kerplunk on the dashboard in the sun, and yeah, melted it.
Yeah.
But hey, you got a CD out of
it. That's true. But I don't know. I guess I'll kind of leave it this way. Like, looking back on the album 30 years later, do you feel like the album still holds up today?
Absolutely, 100%.
Because it
plays two things. It's not only does it stand up as a snapshot of that era, of that of where punk was and where it was going, but it still holds up as just good music.
Yeah,
that resonates. A lot of those songs still do, like even lyrically, resonate with the youth of today, or at least it could. It's kind of universal themes.
Yeah,
but there's nothing about that album that screams 90s. But everything about it screams 90s too. It's very strange. There's other albums that have that benefit or that timelessness.
Yeah.
But Dookie definitely has a timeless quality to it. Like I said, it screams the era it is in, but it can be played anytime and it fits every era.
Yeah. There's a reason why it's the highest selling punk album of all time.
Right. And there's, I mean, even if you take the punk out of it, it's still a fantastically successful album,
yeah,
you know, across the board.
Yeah, I mean, looking back on it, you know, 30 years later, yeah, I would 100% agree that it still stands up. You know, it still has some of my favorite Green Day songs on it, you know, it's still an album I still listen to. I was just listening to it within the last couple of days. It's probably, I would say there's probably not a month that goes by where I don't listen to Dookie, at least part of it.
Right. Yeah, it's always part of, like, if I'm being lazy and I just do shuffle, I've got it in all my Spotify playlists, yeah. So it's always popping up, songs here and there. And I just did a recent front to back re-listen of it about a month ago myself, just because, you're right, it's an album that's timeless.
Yeah. So... No, it's, you know, like I said, I don't know. There's not a whole lot else I can say about it, but I don't know. It's, you know, it's definitely a 10 out of 10 album for me. You know, and I
would agree with that.
You know, and I'd still, you know, even in like Dookie's catalog, I mean, in Green Day's catalog, I still think and I know a lot of people out there probably wouldn't agree, but I still think it's their best album.
Yeah, I don't think I would agree with that, but, I also probably have the benefit of having come to them a little later than you.
Yeah.
Maybe appreciate some of their later stuff a little bit more. Because yeah. I know for the longest time, Warning was my favorite Green Day album. And I know you didn't agree with that because obviously Dookie's your favorite.
Yeah.
But I love Warning because I think that is a hugely experimental album.
Oh, absolutely.
It's probably, for them. Because, I mean,
it might be their most experimental album because of how drastically different it was from anything that came out before that album.
I mean, it was still Green Day. There was still that Green Day DNA there, but there were so many acoustic pieces I love Warning. To this day, it's still probably it might still be my favorite Green Day album, honestly. But
so I guess I'll leave it this way. If you haven't listened to Dookie in a while, go listen to it.
And if you've never listened to it, then shame on you. Go listen to it.
Yeah. But any questions or comments, you can email us at entnowpod@gmail.com. Check us out on Facebook and YouTube and give us the old thumbs up and all that YouTube-y kind of stuff. Anything else you want to add, Ian?
No.
No. No.
No. No.
All right, man.
No!
Until next time.
Talk to y'all later.
Peace. Playing my role, let me tell you about it. This shit right here, man, I'm about it. Only real niggas reside around me. Yo, lady, drop a guard around me. Dip like I know you can, bitch. Show me the ropes like we in the ring. Got you two cobras, you wanna hang. Shoulder to shoulder, the niggas basic. You know I won't lie. You know that I ain't for that fuck shit. You niggas aight, but I'm way better and she love it. Know that y'all sick as fuck. Here go this tissue, bruh. We taking a dub, hoping you get you some. This hit like a pick-me-up. She taking my drugs. Know they see the sign. That's some dollar sign. Know they sick as fuck. Know they sick as fuck. Tell them get well soon. Tell them get well soon. Know you sick as fuck. Get well soon. Oh shit. Watch out, you the girl.
make placement to your eye. Niggas sick as fuck, standing with niggas who die for that party, who die for some bitches who showing their bodies. Swear to God, nigga, this Molly got me up and rolling. These bodies of water, rain that shit in bottles. We mosh at the party, they hate when we styling.